Hi folks, Sam Cedar here. I am stuffed. I ate too much dessert. I had too much turkey and stuffing and sweet potatoes and whatever that other white material was. I don't know. I ate it. I didn't really think twice about it. I'm exhausted. Mila has been difficult today. But I'm not going to take that out on you. So here it is. It's Thanksgiving Day, and I realize I'm not going to have a show for you on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, and I'm not going shopping or anything like that. I know it's Black Friday, and as an American, it's my job to stimulate the economy, but I can't be bothered with that. Not now. Instead, what I'm going to do is tee up for you an interview I did several years ago on Cedar on Sunday with the great Naomi Klein about her book, The Shock Doctrine. The interview is just as timely today as it was then. The book is still an incredibly important read. And as we get closer to the showdown with the attempt to cut Social Security in the name of deficit cutting, which if you listen to the show on a regular basis, you know, is a sack of crap. A lot of what Naomi Klein is talking about here can be applied to this scenario. So sit back, enjoy, or, you know, don't sit back. Jog. Go jog. Or walk around the mall. Just listen. Okay, and we'll be back live on Monday. See you then.
The seventh day, God rested, and Cedar worked. It's Cedar on Sundays.
It is Sunday, February 3rd, 2008, and welcome to the Super Bowl Sunday edition of Cedar on Sundays. Today on the show, Naomi Klein, journalist for The Nation magazine and author of the best-selling book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Naomi Klein is a best-selling author and award-winning investigative journalist. She's a columnist for The Nation magazine and The Guardian newspaper out of Britain. She co-directed the documentary The Take, following the labor activism that grew out of the 2001 crisis in Argentina. She has authored three books, including No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, and Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Globalization Debate. Her latest book is The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, which covers the secret history of the so-called free market capitalism. And regular listeners undoubtedly know of my constant referral to her seminal piece on the occupation of Iraq, Baghdad Year Zero, for Harper's Magazine. Welcome to the show, Naomi.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be back with you.
So now, am I right in guessing that the book, at the very least, it seems that the germ of the idea came out of that piece you did for Harper's Magazine?
That's right. And the DNA of the book is in that piece. Except for that piece was just focusing exclusively on Iraq, and this book is applying the framework that came out of that research internationally, globally, and actually creating an alternative history of the rise of a radical free market economics that sort of culminated in this wild project of trying to turn Iraq into a model, totally corporatized economy after the invasion, like just tracing that history, how we got there. But it absolutely came out of that process. You know, in that piece, I talk about how the shock and awe campaign, the shock and awe of an attack on Iraq, was harnessed to push through what economists call economic shock therapy. And when people rose up and refused to be guinea pigs in this, you know, U.S. experiment, that's when a third shock emerged, the shock of torture. So I came back from Iraq, and after writing that article, I just wanted to understand how shock works. I wanted to trace, you know, this obsessive use of this metaphor, and that's what led to the book. And that was 2004, so it's taken me a while to flesh this out.
Well, it's been well worth it, and the book basically takes these two theories that sort of merged back in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s. One had to do with shock as applied to human beings, specific individuals, I guess I should say, in an attempt to, I guess, rebuild their personalities. Tell us about that, because that's basically how you start out the book.
Yeah, I started out, so when I got back from Iraq, I wanted to understand how shock works. I wanted to understand why economists use the phrase economic shock therapy, how shock therapy is supposed to work. And I read the Shock and Awe manual to try to understand it, but that doesn't explain much because it's just completely insane. So I read the declassified CIA interrogation manuals, which were actually a lot more useful. These are the manuals that the CIA published in 1963 that are handbooks for how to break down prisoners, and they were declassified in the late 90s. Many people have forgotten that they exist, but they're online, and they are manuals for how to use shock to erase personalities, to unmake people. You know, we see these methods used in Guantanamo, sensory deprivation, the goggles, the headphones, the hooding, the isolation, the religious degradation. You know, all of this is about unmaking individuals, you know, taking away the story of who they are. I mean, how do we know who we are? We know who we are because of, knowing where we are in time and space and having a story about ourselves. So these are unmaking procedures.
And I when you mention that, I can't help but remember the pictures I saw of Jose Padilla when he was in prison, and of course he was in prison in the United States at a camp, I think in North Carolina. And they took him out of his cell. Now, here's a guy, obviously, no threat to anyone at this juncture. And there are no other prisoners there, theoretically, that he could communicate to and pass secrets, which ultimately turned out to be he had no secrets, really. But he was in these massive ear protective things and these big black goggles. And it really wasn't until I read your book that I understood why they were doing that to this guy, and the subsequent stories about just how reduced down to almost like a childlike mentality this guy had become by the time the Bush administration put him through the criminal justice system. And this comes out of your research that you did on this Ewan Cameron, is that it?
Yeah, well, when I read the CIA manuals and this section on sensory deprivation and how to put prisoner into shock, they refer to the McGill experiments. So I looked into it, and I found myself reading more declassified documents relating to the so-called MKUltra experiments that were conducted in the 1950s, where hospitals, universities, psychologists, psychiatrists, by the dozens, were paid by the CIA to conduct all kinds of experiments into what at the time they called mind control. But what we now know is that they were doing research into prison interrogation, into breaking down personalities. And some of the most ambitious experiments took place at McGill University involving Ewan Cameron, who was an American psychiatrist who got the post as head of psychiatry at McGill University. And he was put in charge of a psychiatric hospital called the Allen Memorial Hospital. And he turned the Allen in the 1950s and early 60s into his shock laboratory. And he used massive doses of electroshock, LSD, sensory deprivation, all of these bizarre methods in the name of curing his patients. But he believed that the way to cure his patients was to erase their existing personalities because they had a mental illness and just start over, reboot their brains.
And you use this as an analogy, and in some respects it's a direct parallel to how, I guess, the free marketers, how they use this type of shock, this notion of having a clean slate to truly develop their notion of a radically free market.
It's obvious that this is a theory that is deeply anti-human. You can't erase people and start over from scratch. All you do by blasting them with all these techniques is you shatter them, you destroy them, you destroy their minds. In fact, the same is true of countries. That's what was so striking to me about, all of this shock tactics. And, that Harper's article, the Baghdad Year Zero, the reason why I called it that is because this was the same theory. It was not rebuild Iraq, but reboot Iraq. Start it over from zero. Erase it. Use great violence to clean the slate. But in Iraq, the slate wasn't cleaned either, just like with these psychiatric patients. It was scrambled. It was ruptured. It was broken. It was stirred up because, neither people nor countries reboot to zero.
When we come back from the break, I'll be talking with Naomi about the two Friedmen, Milton and Thomas. Both have mustaches.
Sticks and stones may break his bones, but conservative lies will only make him stronger. Sam Cedar, only on Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the Super Bowl Super Book Show. I'm talking to Naomi Klein about her latest book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. The notion of this shock and awe and sort of taking this back down to a clean slate even lent itself to the U.S. forces allowing the looting in some of the museums as a way of simply saying, like, we got to take it all away. We've got to completely wipe out every point of reference that this society had to its existence prior to shock and awe.
Well, exactly. And I'm not saying that they planned the looting, but Donald Rumsfeld's famous shrug when confronted with the sacking of Baghdad and the sacking of the museum, the famous shrug, stuff happens. You know, the enemy of this blanking project is memory. It's the memory and culture of the society that was. I mean, if you're, Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, he actually wrote at the time that the project in Iraq was not nation building, but nation creating. And then they're surprised that this turns into a bloody mess. You know, how do you create a nation when there's already a nation there without using tremendous violence and ultimately it breaking down into ethnic cleansing?
And how do you perceive of something like that without having something really missing inside your brain?
Monstrous idea, yeah.
I mean, some notion of humanity. I mean, I can't think of Thomas Friedman without thinking of his famous line of that we needed to send some American boys and girls over there with a gun to break down their door and just basically say, suck on this. I think he's probably knee-deep in antidepressants now, trying to forget that episode of him on Charlie Rose. But let's get back to Milton Friedman here.
The other Friedman. My husband, Evie, wanted me to call the book Friedman Fighter.
Yeah.
Anyway, no relation.
Right. except for perhaps in sharing some elements of neoliberal thought.
And also missing some, that little part of their brain that tells them that there are actually people involved in these experiments. So what I do in the book is I trace the roots of these different forms of shock. So I trace the methods of torture that we're seeing, as you say, in Guantanamo, in the Jose Padilla case, back to the original shock laboratory at McGill University. But I also trace the roots of the economic shock therapists, the people who thought they could remake Russia using economic shock therapy and who thought they could remake Iraq using economic shock therapy. This equally brutal idea. back to the original laboratory, which was the University of Chicago Economics Department in the 1950s under the leadership of one Milton Friedman. And I look at how a generation of economists, particularly Latin American economists, who were brought to the University of Chicago to study under Friedman, to be indoctrinated in this radical vision of the world where there it was the only acceptable role for the government was just to enforce contracts and protect private property, and everything else should be handled by corporations, letting the profit motive govern. And it's taken a long time, but we're actually getting, you know, Milton Friedman's world.
Well, let's start with Chile, because this is essentially where he had his first, opportunity to use this type of shock therapy. And unlike the disaster capitalism that you talk about in your book, this was, perhaps it was a disaster, but not so much a natural one.
No, it was a created one by a military coup.
Yeah, let's just talk about this. So in 1973, Salvador Allende is in power in Chile. He has what could be considered a socialist government, where he's actually running his government as a vehicle to help the lives of all the people in Chile. And this is very problematic for the powers that be in this country.
Yes.
Because part of that agenda is using the natural resources of Chile to benefit the Chilean people.
Yes.
Which was obviously a problem for large companies like ITT.
Yes, and American mining companies, particularly copper mining companies. And Nixon famously said, make the economy scream, after Allende was elected. So there was a crisis that was created, a disaster that was created that culminated in the military coup, in Pinochet's military coup. But by the time Pinochet used such tremendous violence to overthrow the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende, the country was already reeling from this manufactured economic crisis because the economy was indeed screaming because of this embargo.
Now, Pinochet, in addition to this coup, probably being at least encouraged in some respects by the CIA, if not fully financed, Pinochet was in contact with people of this Chicago school and ready to hit the ground running with these type of so-called reforms.
Yes, there was a direct link with the University of Chicago, and that's because the State Department had been very concerned about the rise of who they called the pink economists, left-wing economists, who had all these crazy ideas about keeping the wealth of Latin America in Latin America to the extent possible rather than exporting it to the United States. In a bid to take on the pink economists, the State Department launched a program that they called the Chile Project, which involved bringing more than 100 Chilean students to the University of Chicago to study at this radical economic school. And, we talk about the coup in Chile as if it was just a military coup, but it was really a partnership between these economists, who were also backed by the CIA, and the military. The military provided the muscle to overthrow Allende, but the Chicago boys had all the ideas, to the extent that on September 11th, 1973, the night that Allende was overthrown and the night that he died, this group of Chicago-trained economists stayed up all night mimeographing an economic program for Chile called the BRIC. And in the BRIC, you had the outlines of this sort of extreme country makeover. It was everything from like school vouchers, charter schools, privatization of Social Security, privatization of everything in sight, flat tax, free trade. I mean, it was George Bush's 2000 election campaign, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed up all night making copies of this document, and it was on the desk of every one of the military leaders the first morning they reported for work.
Stay tuned for more of my interview with Naomi Klein right after the break on this special edition of Cedar on Sunday.
Cedar on Sunday. Sam Cedar.
Welcome back to Cedar on Sundays, the special Super Bowl Super Sunday book show. This hour, we're replaying one of my greatest hits, my interview with Naomi Klein, columnist for The Nation magazine and The Guardian. Her new book is The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism.
And so so Pinochet puts a lot of these suggestions into force in Chile. And how did that work out?
The first couple of years were disastrous, so disastrous that in 1975, that unemployment was so high, inflation was so high, that they had to bring in the really big gun. They brought Milton Friedman all the way to Chile to directly advise Pinochet. And his advice, like all fundamentalists, was you need more. You mm-hmm. haven't applied the rules strictly enough. And he used the phrase shock treatment to describe what he thought that Pinochet should do. And you know, I actually have this letter between Pinochet and Friedman on my website, shockdoctrine.org, if anybody is interested in reading this very interesting historical document.
And so it led to just incredible inflation, and essentially what we're seeing in this country and around the world, a tremendous bifurcation of basically, or concentration of the wealth.
Exactly, a stratification of wealth, and all the while, the there was this third shock. There was the shock of the coup. There was the economic shock treatment. But there was also, all the while, the shock of the torture chamber, the body shocks, the non-metaphorical shocks enforcing these economic policies. But, of course, there was the constant denial that there was any relationship between trying to impose these policies that create a world of have and have-nots, that erode labor protections and make life so much more precarious and so much harder for people, and these methods of enforcement, these methods of state terror that say to people, you know, if you resist, the worst will happen to you. I call it a political cleansing because the left was the dominant culture in Latin America at this time. And, it was left-wing musicians. It was theater directors. It was psychologists. It was anybody who was associated with the left.
Let's talk a little bit about Jeffrey Sachs. Who is Jeffrey Sachs, and where is he in this a spectrum of Chicago boys?
Well, he's not a Chicago boy. He's a Harvard man. But he was a Harvard man in the 80s. And by the height of Reaganism, the Chicago school ideology had really come to dominate all the Ivy League schools, and it was becoming just the economic orthodoxy at all the top institutions. So Jeffrey Sachs was just, a man of his time. I mean, he's not a classic Chicago boy in the sense that I think, I tend to, like we said, I think, Milton Friedman had that part of his brain missing. And I don't believe that he honestly thought that imposing these brutal policies was the best way to end poverty. We often hear, maybe they're just idealists, but they just have a different way of trying to make the world
right.
A better place. I don't think that's the case with a lot of the Chicago boys. But I think with Jeffrey Sachs, I think he is somebody who is driven by a desire to fight poverty and to have more economic justice. And he's a sort of strange mixture between a Keynesian and a Harvard man of the 80s. So he tried to mix a radical vision of a free market economics with a desire for a lot of foreign aid and support. So he's a complicated figure. But in the 80s, when a lot of these dictatorships ended and there was a burgeoning human rights movement and a lot of these overt shock tactics became less tenable. Jeffrey Sachs sort of took over from Milton Friedman as the preeminent global shock doctor. And he traveled from Bolivia to Poland to Russia, all over Latin America, Argentina, Brazil, advising governments to use economic shock therapy to get out of their debt and hyperinflation crises. So I look at Jeffrey Sachs as a complicated figure because many of these places, the use of shock was accompanied by repression and highly anti-democratic measures, not as anti-democratic as a military coup, but definitely anti-democratic in the sense of governments doing something that is the direct opposite of what they were elected to do, which was the case in Bolivia, which was his first sort of foray into international economic advising.
And we see that same sort of dynamic certainly in Poland as well. But let me just for a moment to go back to Milton Friedman, because the distinction here between a Milton Friedman who really never, I think, sees the world or saw the world functioning on a level of a certain group of peoples, and that's the way you measure success of civilization. If this one group of elite succeeds, then civilization has made progress, and sort of without any recognition that he's dealing with human beings whose lives are theoretically as valuable as any other human being's lives. Is it a coincidence, do you think, that Milton Friedman came out of University of Chicago when you also have this sort of Straussian ideology that comes out of there, too, that it also sort of is centered around this notion that there are some who are born to lead others and they simply know better than the rest of the riffraff?
I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it was very much in the air. And I think there's a real synergy in their ideas. And a lot of people who were at University of Chicago at this time were exposed to both men's ideas, and they are really mutually reinforcing. Because I think the best way to understand this economic project is what Milton Friedman tried to and successfully did was, you know, convince the world that what we used to think of as politics, of political choices that democratically elected governments could make in order to shape societies. And this was, you know, this was the Keynesian ethos, you know, after the Great Depression and the creation of, you know, the New Deal and the Great Society. I mean, this was the idea that elected politicians really could shape the types of economies that they wanted. This was the can-do government, right? Mm-hmm. And what Milton Friedman believed was that economics was a hard science and that mere mortals really shouldn't interfere. And he was one of these guys with a real complex about science, and this is actually something he shared with some of the psychiatrists I studied, where they really want to be taken seriously as real doctors, you know, and so they start using all of these these sort of surgical methods and so on, because they want to show that they don't just talk to their patients, they do things. Well, I think that with Friedman, that he had this real complex, and he talked about this a lot, that economics was just as hard a science as chemistry. And he wanted to argue that mere mortals shouldn't try to influence economics through policy. They should just leave the economy alone. But part of this was the idea that you should depoliticize economic policymaking and hand it over to technocrats. Right? And technocrats are men like Alan Greenspan, say, right? You know, who, as we know, was a hardcore ideologue whose worldview was shaped by Ayn Rand, right? So, you know, a lot of this was a blurring of the line, or it was ideologues sort of posing as neutral technocrats or just sort of giant computers who don't have any ideological baggage, but in fact they have this very ideological view of the world. So that's where the Straussian worldview fits. I mean, it's really this idea of just leave it to this small group of people who are just better than the rest of us and take it out of the realm of democracy. And you can still let people vote, but they're not allowed to vote for anything really important. We'll leave that to the kingmakers and the technocrats.
You know, we can see the ripples of this even down the line in terms of how right wing and movement conservative talk radio show hosts talk about these things. I mean, this is why they hate the idea of man and societies and governments being able to affect things like global warming. This notion that people can actually make decisions about their broader context and actually affect change is an anathema to them, because this is how people mobilize, and they have done this in many different realms where they have said, you know, why are you trying to politicize the war? Well, the war is a political decision that has been made. Why are you trying to politicize healthcare? Well, healthcare is a political decision. They have made politics. They have defined it down to basically the horse race, and have basically sucked all the ability for democracies and citizens to impact their broader societies through what is called politics.
Iraq was an amazing example of this. And, you know, just I think Iraq is useful, like looking at that first year. Under Paul Bremer is an incredible window into what these people mean when they talk about democracy, right? I mean, if we think about what Paul Bremer did in that first year, it was this mad rush to change absolutely everything about Iraq, to lock in. He wrote 100 laws, right? He completely re-engineered the society, made it the widest open free market in the world. He passed all kinds of laws that were highly ideological, like 100%, you know, foreign companies can own 100% of Iraqi assets and take 100% of their profits out. You know,
no these are, labor unions, et cetera.
Exactly.
Et cetera.
But it was all posed and positioned as if it was just, a technicality, right? You know, of course, any good government would want, you know, a 15% flat tax, never mind that, you know, they couldn't even get that passed in the United States. But it was this whole package of policies, and all the while, you know, Paul Wolfowitz is saying we're bringing democracy to Iraq, but this is their vision of democracy. You send in Paul Bremer to make every crucial decision that the country will face, lock it in a constitution, and then at the end of it all, say, okay, you can vote now, right? I mean, they have an unbelievably impoverished vision of what democracy actually means. And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is say this is actually not democracy.
Stay tuned for the last segment of my conversation with Naomi Klein. I'll ask her what we can do to counteract this shock doctrine, and she'll give us some solutions and some hope about how we can affect our future on this special book show, Cedar on Sundays.
Cat got your tongue? Well, unless it's got your computer, too, you can email us at samcedarshow@gmail.com or join in the conversation at samcedarshow.com. America Radio.
Welcome back to the Super Bowl Super Book Show. I'm talking to Naomi Klein about her latest book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism.
Let's talk about some of the positive things that you report on. You continue the metaphor of the shock and suggest that there are examples of the shock wearing off. You talk about this in Chile, and you talk about this in Lebanon. Tell us just a little bit about this, so that we can express some hope for the future. And frankly, I think the response that your book has gotten, the mainstreaming, if you will, of your book, I think is an incredibly hopeful sign to me, at least, that this is now a topic of discussion, that people are beginning to see past this sort of blanket and knee-jerk reaction that democracy and a government that only allows corporations to do whatever they want are not synonymous.
Yeah. You know, I have to say I've been really encouraged. And obviously sounds a little self-serving for me to be encouraged by the response to the book in the U.S. But, you know, what encourages me about it is that as I talk to audiences here, the people are drawn to the book because they know that the horse race is not going to fix things. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is a real difference. This is a real difference from 2004. It's a real difference from 2006. There's almost a sense of pre-disappointment about the outcome of the 2008 elections. I mean, people, People know that the problems are deeper and bipartisan. And yes, they want the Republicans out, as well they should. But there's a lot less naivete about what that's actually going to mean. I mean, I think people have a sense that that is just the first step.
Right.
And there is this desire, and I also see hope in the skepticism with which people are approaching Bush's claims about Iran. Not enough, but a lot more. One of the most encouraging, the book has come out in Spanish, came out in Spanish last week, and I went to Spain, to present the book, and it was really interesting to be in Spain in that moment because they had just handed down the verdicts for the bombers of the March 11th Madrid train bombings. And that was interesting as an outsider to see because it was like, you know, they did this in a court system publicly, like, you know, got convictions, the criminal process actually works. So that was interesting to see that.
As a juxtaposition, as opposed to...
Well, they didn't, you know, send people to, you know, black site prisons, torture them, you know. They actually just, you know, used police work, arrested them, brought them to trial, you know, in the public realm, got convictions, debated whether they were good convictions or bad convictions. But, you know, they didn't throw their constitution out because they had been attacked. And it was interesting talking to Spaniards about why their response to those attacks was so different than the response to the September 11th attacks in North America. And
what did you find?
What I found was, well, first of all, I mean, it was very dramatic what happened in Spain, that you had a very Bush-friendly government at the time, headed by José María Aznar, who did his very best George Bush impersonation immediately after the bombings. You know, he blamed the Basque separatists, who actually weren't to blame. He said, this is why we're in Iraq. I used it, you know, for political capital, even though it had nothing to do with Iraq. Or maybe it had something to do with Iraq, but, he was using it for short-term political gain. And he was using it to keep people afraid. And people were really worried that they were about to lose civil liberties, constitutional rights, that it was going to become a fear-driven society. And they poured out of their homes in these huge demonstrations and had these demonstrations against fear. And it was, you know, really interesting that you could have a demonstration against fear. But I think it's a great model, actually. And then they proceeded to vote out Aznar's party and vote in a party that was promising to pull troops out of Iraq the next day. But when I talked to people in Spain about why they responded so negatively to their government in that moment, they said, well, Aznar reminded us of Franco. And it was that they had a historical memory, and they understood how the politics of shock worked because it had worked on them in the past. That in the past they had given up their freedoms for the promise of security, but they had metabolized that past, and they were learning from the mistakes, and they weren't going to let it happen again. So memory, and this is why history is so important, and it's why I think, you know, why after September 11th, you know, when people tried to learn the history, understand where al-Qaeda came from, understand U.S. complicity in Afghanistan and the funding of the Mujahideen, you know, why that was treated as so threatening by the Bush administration. You know, history is shock resistance, and that's why I wrote this alternative history. Because I actually feel like we need a story. We need a story that we can hold on to that will make us resistant in these moments of shock.
Well, that's a great place to end. Naomi Klein, thank you so much for joining us. The book is The Shock Doctrine. We just skimmed the surface in this interview, folks. So you've got to pick this up. And it'll make a great Christmas gift. Or a Hanukkah gift, or a Thanksgiving gift, or just a thanks for being my friend's gift, I guess.
Thanks for being my friend, Sam. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for coming on.